This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices. Bow hunters are some of the hardest working hunters there are. Most of us work hard all year long just to get a couple weekends or burn our vacation time to sit in a tree. And just like the American blue-collar worker, we're trying to balance work, family, faith, and a little time for ourselves in the great outdoors. Now let me introduce you to Trollco Clothing, a brand built by blue-collar workers for blue-collar workers. Workwear, comfortable tees, hoodies and hats for both men and women, Trollco represents the hardworking American. So whether you're operating heavy equipment, wrenching on engines, or in a factory living that shift life, Trollco has your back, literally. Head to trollco.com/hunting. That's trollco.com/hunting and enter the discount code Empire25 for 25% off of your first order. Trollco, for the hardworking American. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Sierra has all the best active and outdoor brands you need, from athletic stuff, like a full-court pickup game, swish, to athletic-ish stuff, like a half-mile stroll. Get those steps in! And for morning hikes up the mountain trail, good pace, to nighttime ghost stories from the camping chair. What a twist! Whatever level of active, Sierra loves it all. Head to Sierra or Sierra.com for the brands you want at the prices that let you do it all. From athletic to athletic-ish, Sierra's got it.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
Spring break isn't what it used to be. It's better. This spring, stay 3 nights and get a $50 Best Western gift card. Life's a trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Visit bestwestern.com for complete terms and conditions.
This episode is brought to you by Peloton. Break through the busiest time of year with the brand new Peloton Cross Training Tread Plus. Powered by Peloton IQ. With real-time guidance and endless ways to move, you can personalize your workouts and train with confidence, helping you reach your goals in less time. Let yourself run, lift, sculpt, push, and go. Explore the new Peloton Cross Training Tread Plus at onepeloton.com.
Welcome to Maximize Your Hunt, the podcast dedicated to those who want the most out of their hunting property. This podcast explores land management, habitat improvement, and hunting strategies that will help you maximize your time in the field. Follow along as industry professionals that live and breathe whitetail deer share their secrets to success. And now, the founder of Whitetail Landscapes, your host, John Teeter.
I'm John Teeter, Whitetail Landscapes. This is Maximize Your Hunt. Welcome back, everybody. I am home this morning, taking it easy. I had a bunch of projects going on yesterday. Last night I got home from a visit, and I did some work on my land. I've got my Habitat Day coming up this weekend, so I'm doing some preparatory work for that. I had to cut some trails out, and I got caught in a massive rainstorm. So I sat in a box blind for about an hour and a half while a thunderstorm came overhead and just pummeled my area. I had some storm damage, and obviously I hate having any heavy equipment on my property during wet time. So I kind of got stuck with the tractor. I have a walk-behind brush cutter. I've been using a walk-behind brush cutter since 1998. And so I was in my, at that point, I think I was 18 years old. I was 16 years old. Young kid using, I used to rent it. I bought one, I don't know, 12 years ago, something like that. And I've used it ever since. And I think those are most invaluable tool you could have. They're super light. They do an excellent job cutting. You can get extremely tight spaces. A lot of people don't want to cut trails into their property for whatever reason. They think it devoids utilization of deer. I have found that these small 26-inch walk-behind brush cutters to be probably one of the best pieces of equipment you can invest in. And, you know, I think I bought it used. I think it was about $1,600, and it's been fantastic. I've had no issues with it. It's the brand is Billy Goat, but it's a gear-driven one. I wanted a hydrostatic. They didn't come out with those till I think maybe a year or two later when I initially purchased mine, or I don't know. I think it was a significant more expense. DR makes one. There's other companies that make those, but what a great piece of equipment. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, I'll laugh. I could damage anything. I think I'm notorious for breaking stuff. I think that's probably one of my strong suits. If you can produce it, I will break it. I should be the product tester for every product in the market. I would go through a pair of lacrosse boots in 3 weeks. They would not stand any of my walking. You know, I'm a pretty fast paced mover, and I don't take my time, and I damage things. But even last night, good example. So that walk by a brush cutter, I have a carry all on the back of my tractor. So I bring it over in the carry all. Instead of using like my flail mower, which I typically use for these, I wanted kind of intimate trails, kind of maneuvering through areas. Doesn't the walk behind fall off the machine? I had it tied down, but it somehow loosened and fell off the machine. So yeah, again, you know, user error there. Should have tied it down better. But you know, I didn't pop a tire, but you know, it basically jarred one of my tires. So I had to fix that this morning. I could constantly break everything. I'm a glutton for punishment. So when I come home, it's usually what maintenance do I have to do on the equipment that I have. So don't let me borrow any of your equipment. That's probably the lesson here. All right, enough of my rambling. Let's get into the details. And I got Matt Williams back. Matt, what's up, buddy? How you been?
Good. How you doing, John?
Good, man. So I got a lot of feedback from you on the last podcast. People think you're like an interesting character, which you are. And hopefully you don't take offense to that.
No, I mean, it's whatever. I'm just trying to be myself. Everybody else is already taken.
Yeah, no, that's good. So if everybody doesn't remember, we did a podcast on introducing mushrooms on your landscape. So I want you to talk a little bit about, I don't know, anything that you got going on right now, maybe some projects that you're working on, new ideas, concepts, anything to do with your business.
Well, I'm going through the throes of a new 40-acre property. So there's that. I've been interviewing foresters and loggers for 6 months, and I finally found the one I like. And so that's pretty awesome. And it looks like things are going to move quickly on the property now. I've been experimenting. I'm an experimenter. I have a curious mind. I got questions and I need answers and can't find them. So I got to do some work myself. So, right now, one of the things I'm hot and heavy on is like white and green ribbed varieties of forage plants like chicory and then I'm using non-traditional, I guess they would be garden crops, but I'm using them in plots. So I hate purple top turnips with a passion and fury of 10,000 blazing white hot suns, but I love kohlrabi. And as a market farmer, I know the, you know, deer tear up certain crops. So I'm playing with kohlrabi and Swiss chard, and I've got pie pumpkins and corn interplanted with beans and peas, and then I've got mushrooms in the bottom of that. So the bears steal all of our like salt rocks, and you know, if you put out a trophy rock or something like that, or a block, so the bears steal those and they drag them out in the swamp and blah blah blah. And so I've been messing around with making a paste out of molasses and minerals with a little bit of salt, and then applying that to rocks with like lots of nooks and crannies. to get the deer and the other critters to lick on it. And that's been working really well as well. And it's actually costing me a lot less money on my minerals now because of that. So I got a tree nursery growing. And I don't know, man, I got a lot of stuff going.
Well, let's slow down. Let's go back to some of the things you were talking about earlier. And I appreciate this point. You hate purple top turnips with a passion, and so do I. So it's funny that we think the same. Why do you hate them?
They're a really finicky crop, number one. They're sold as an easy crop. And, yeah, they're easy to get growing, quote-unquote, but to grow them as a highly attractive forage over other forages is very difficult, in my opinion. One, they're of like a lot of those root crops, they're very sensitive to the soil conditions and compaction, as well as they need a lot of trace minerals, especially boron. If you walk through your plots and you snap your brassica stems in half and you look at them, if they're hollow, that's because they're not getting enough boron, and it's hard for the soil to transfix enough boron for those heavy crops like that. It takes, what, generally like 3 years before the deer will start to eat them. Well, if I'm going to plant something I want the deer to eat in 3 years, it's going to be a tree, you know, with apples on it or something, you know, not an annual endeavor. So there's a bunch of different reasons. And mostly brassicas don't form soil mycorrhizal exchanges. Plus, those root crops, when left to rot, generally harbor pests like wireworms and, you know, cutworms and all kinds of other things. Don't get me wrong. There's other, you know, good predatory insects that jump in there as well eventually, but there's just a pile of reasons.
Yeah, and a lot of those I can echo. I think the biggest thing for me is, I'll just be very simple with this, is what is the actual value of that plant compared to other comparable plants? Now, typically, I like rape, and I also introduce, so I think of the root architecture as well as the biomass structure. One of the things I want to mention, I think a lot of people miss out on with these cultured crops or these this new way of having, you know, Ponderosa-style food plots, is you do lose out on biomass. I think people want to argue that it's equivalent biomass to some of these monocrops. It is not, at least in my experience. And so culturally, we're used to these kind of lush, you know, large food plots with, you know, volumes of biomass in the thousands. And what we get away from is we realize that, you know, diverse diet, and each one of these particular species, like ones you were introducing a second ago, have a different particular benefit on the landscape. Brassicas in and of themselves, and any tuber related to that, needs to serve a purpose. Generally speaking, aeration is low in the soil. Most soils that I've been on, is compaction is 90% of the issue. We do not have oxygen in the soil. So purple top turnip is not going to aerate your soil, similar to what it would be comparable as some of these Korean radish options, daikon radish as an example. So, you know, thinking about aerating your soil is critical. Equipment, so anything that slices or pulls. So if you are not like this, you know, you're this big no-till person, and I have a no-till drill, but I would not consider myself a no-till person. I think tillage is, smart tillage is fine. But aeration, ability to get deeper in the soil profile and apply nutrients like calcium, right? Those are really critical to the equation here. And you know, this weekend on my land, when we do my habitat day, I'm going to talk about ways to fix soil. And I think I'm going to lose some people because they're like, you know, we're just throwing down MPK sulfate-based fertilizer. I'm like, well, there's way better options out there, folks. Like, if that's where you're at and that's what you're trying to do to your landscape, you're neutering your soil. That's the best way to put it. You're neutering your soil and you're limiting your ceiling. And I have been able to increase with my refractometer, I measure this as Brix or sucrose or sugar levels or glucose levels, if you want to, you know, you're looking at root composition. I've been able to increase that 1 or 2 Brix levels every single year. So it tells you what I'm doing is working. And what that means is a more sugar nutrient rich plant is going to be higher interest values, higher digestibility of the rumen, better rumen microbacteria in their gut, right? They can process through some of those. And purple top turnips just don't do it for me, man. So when it comes down to it, I don't think that crop is really one of those complete crops. Or, you know, the way that tuber sits on the landscape, it just, I don't see it consumed at a high rate. It just, again, usually you're sulfur deficient. needs and demands a lot of sulfur. So there's a complexity piece of this that I think we miss out on quite often. So that's my rant on that. Let's talk about replacement. So you mentioned another type of plant. Let's talk a little bit about that. What are your thoughts there?
Carrots are my go-to right now, but I'm also using kohlrabi and some beets as well. Now, when it comes to these varieties, I'm seeking out either something in the that has white variegation or white stems or green stems versus reds and purples. For whatever reason, deer just tear up anything with white and green. If you put, let's say you put forage chicory out and it's got a purple stem and you put white chicory out right next to it, well, the white chicory is going to be gone pretty fast. And the green the red chicory sticks around for a long time. So I'm messing with carrots, especially small ones the size of a golf ball that are called Parisian carrots, so that even if the ground's frozen, they can be accessed similar to a small turnip. I'm looking more at baby beets than regular beets, like the Detroit Reds or something like that. There's a lot of different color variegations available on those. I'm using white kohlrabi, which is kind of like a mix between an apple and a soft cabbage and a turnip, kind of all blended together. If you've never had it, it makes an amazing coleslaw. I'm messing with some stuff that is in my wheelhouse as a produce farmer.
Love it.
And, also, you know, I'm an intercropper, so I'm getting, you know, layers in here. I'm going back in with buck oats and peas later in the season and more appropriate planting time. These carrots are generally a longer takeoff, so you kind of start that as your base. And I'm using broccoli, too, as one of my brassicas, and I'm sowing that now because it's a longer takeoff time. The great thing with this with broccoli is if they eat it down, it puts off side shoots. So it's, kind of cut and come again in that regard, unless they knock down the terminus at the beginning. But long story short, I'm just, you know, messing around with stuff that's in my wheelhouse. I'm not opposed to all brassicas, but there are certain brassicas that I look at as filler when it comes to food plots, like cheap seeds. So you could have bought a 10-pound mix with all the good stuff and had a way better food plot than adding in that extra 20 pounds of filler of, you know, and you can come in with those fillers later and do layers. So, just kind of messing around.
I think it's fun. I think people should mess around like that. If you have space in your particular food plot areas where you can try different things and just observe, you know, why not, right? One of my issues in my property, 46 acres, ton of topography change, you know, a couple hundred feet elevation change throughout the property. I've got limited space. I only have 1.7 acres of food plots on my property. And so based on that, I don't have the space available to do a lot of this goofing around. Now in my backyard, I do. So I do a little bit of playing around here in my backyard just to give me some of that variety. And I've really wanted to put more, I have not put the emphasis I need to on trying different things and thinking outside the box, because we both know there's better things out there that, you know, folks are not, you know, clued in. Is like, for example, planting collards in the summertime. A lot of people don't think about that, but again, a highly digestible, utilized food source. And again, introducing plant species that are going to be utilized at different times, seasonality, and thinking about there are nutrient deficient periods based on, you know, I guess, senescence, where, you know, some of these forbs are starting to kind of die off. What are you doing to fill the gap between August and September? Again, this is the Northeast and parts of the Midwest, and obviously where you live in Michigan. You know, what are those gap periods and what are you doing? Like, a lot of times there's a gap. It really irritates me with clients is, and I shouldn't say it like that, but it bothers me that the decision making is simply this. People are starting to plant their fall crops, like sometime mid-July, mid-August. I usually plant sometime in mid-August. And there's a gap period between like July 1st and like August 10th. That's a critical time to have food on your property. And the reason I say that is the social construct of deer is there's a lot of mobility, meaning they're moving around landscapes a lot, evaluating, investigating, right? They're getting their magnifying glasses on and they're looking at the food availability, the doe or herd dynamics in those particular areas. And you're missing out on stealing a deer, stealing a quality buck when you do not have food on your landscape. So if you continue to listen to some of the YouTube folks that say you don't need summer food because there's agriculture all around you, you're making a giant mistake. And I think playing around with some of the combinations as well could be this amplification or opportunity to see what else is out there is a better, you know, maybe a little candy crop in there. And I think maybe in your mixes, are you adding in any beans or anything like that, just to have, Okay. So I think that's, I think that's critical to the equation. Just in my opinion.
Yep. I'm messing with Scarlet Runner beans climbing up corn right now. And I use Milorganite to get those off the woods or off the ground in the woods. Cause they'll get crushed. You don't have a chance in hell of getting them up off the ground, corn or beans, in a small plot in the woods. Well, I use, a fertilizer product. It's out of Milwaukee. It's basically made from human sewage. It smells like terrible, right? And the deer hate it. They'll avoid the area like the plague for about 30 days afterwards, depending on the rainiest, you know, how rainy it is. It's been really wet, so I've had to reapply about every 2.5 weeks this year. But in 250 pounds an acre, well, on a quarter acre, I mean, that's a couple bags. It's no big deal.
Yeah.
And then I kind of localize it to those specific plants versus the whole plot. But and I'm big on corn for screening. I don't really care if it gives me an ear. I mean, I definitely want an ear. Awesome. But at the same time, I use it to kind of partition off my plots. You know what I mean?
Yep.
And create pinches across that plot where there's just a narrow gap. But Three Sisters is a Native American technique that my ancestors used for a long time. And using it, they were able to farm the same lands for 10,000 plus years. And that's saying something. And basically what it is each plant provides structure and nutrition for each other in a, you know, a symbiotic manner or a guild. And so in this system, I'm using mushrooms as a base layer. And then I use beans and peas or one or the other to climb a structure like corn or sunflowers and then squash around the bottom. And the squash in this case is a pie pumpkin, very sugar rich. And then I'm looking for like the tallest dent corn that I can get, of course. And then the it holds the structure. Now, once it gets about 2 or 3 feet tall, that Milorganite doesn't work anymore. So it's kind of survival of the fittest at that point.
Yeah.
Once you get it up, it usually takes off pretty well. And those are just some of the, you know, the holding foods that I'm working on for the deep winter, because deep winter is our primary concern here as a stress period.
Yep.
It's not necessarily the senescence period where the, you know, the alfalfa is browning down and stuff and the forbs are browning down. That's not as usually there's a fair amount of white oaks and other acorns starting to drop all around me. And there's plenty of mushrooms, obviously, at my property. So that's not really a stress issue for me. But the stress issue for me is when the deer yard starts to fill up, meaning the migratory deer north of us start to move south as the snow flies north of us. And we'll get an artificial number of deer in a short period of time. And with that, anything could happen. Bucks galore, you know, you never know. You've never seen this buck before, but he could show up at any moment. But also there's a lot of pressure from does and yearlings that show up in these yards as they migrate through. So I'm trying to keep enough food to maintain them through rifle season when people shoot out their back windows at their houses all around me on the property more than anything else.
All right, let's go back for real quick. So you said you mentioned Milorganite, right? Was that what you were using?
Yeah, that's how I get the beans and the corn off the ground in the woods.
Okay, human sludge, or that's what it's referred to normally. So yeah. What application?
What's that?
The application. How do you apply it on your landscape?
Just grab a broadcast spreader.
Okay. And you're finding that at least the initial stage of plant development, it's done a pretty decent job as long as you're applying it past intervals of rain, so you're consistent about it being on the landscape?
Yeah, you want to hit it. I mean, it's you want to hit it prior to emergence. So basically when you plant it or within a week of planting is you see the first thing pop up. And then you got to monitor your rain. If it's a dry year, it tends to last more like a month and a week versus if it's a wet year, it's like 2.5 weeks, you know. But, yeah, basically that's it. And then I reapply, and I'm just trying to get that corn or whatever to 2 foot tall or 3 foot tall so it has a fighting chance of getting over their head, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And the density of your corn is probably, it's sparse, but at least provides that value of cover that you need in that particular area. That's awesome.
You got it. And I actually leave little lanes through the corn whenever I plant it. And when I plant it on a mushroom food plot, I do it with the jab planter, but there's a no-till drill that's 4 rows wide as well for other applications. But I don't have plots galore. All my plots are a quarter acre, half acre at the most is the new one I'm making. So they're all little, you know, they're log landings basically.
So you said you're making a new plot. Let's talk a little bit about that. How are you going about that?
Well, I tried using high proof vinegar and clove oil, and that was laughable, but I got some pretty good burn on my perimeter with it. So when it came to going inside, I had to step it up and go with some bigger stuff. So I'm using Cornerstone and 2,4-D. And then I use a little bit of diesel fuel as a surfactant in that. And then I've sprayed it twice, three times now. It's great fawning cover up there. There's a lot of, briars. Unfortunately, there's a lot of that up there. And so I just wanted to take this one small area out. But I'm making like a hockey stick sort of shape. And right where it kinks and, turns, more of an L shape, but with a weird kickoff, kind of like a check mark or something.
Yeah.
But right where it kicks, there's one ironwood I'm leaving in that plot for, a scrape tree. They can't lay off the ironwoods up here for some reason for scraping. And then the corn kind of feathers into that as well, comes to a point right near it. So it kind of provides a pinch between two places at the same time. And all this is up on a saddle. It's a double saddle. So food on a saddle, you know how that goes.
Yep. Yep. Huh. Okay. Yep. And you're doing it by hand? I mean, are you clearing by hand?
Okay. Oh boy.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that. Let's talk about clearing a food plot by hand. I want to talk about that. I think a lot of people are in that scenario. You know, how do you think, from your experience, I have my experience in this, done plenty of this, what is the best technique? How do you manage stumps, debris? Would you rather bring in equipment? Like, where's your thoughts process through this whole thing?
I'd rather not bring in equipment, compact my soil and see a bunch of my soil scraped off. But if it's, whiffled and waffled pretty bad, that might be your only choice. Stumpage depends on the count per acre. Mine's pretty low. It's only like 40 to 60 up there where I'm doing this. And once again, it was a big log landing, so there's not much in there. Yeah. And what was in there is 10 years rotten, so you can pretty much touch it with the tractor blade or something and it'll just crumble. And so what I'm doing with any new stumps is I'm actually burning them out. And the way I do that is I turn it into the stump itself into a rocket stove. And what you do is just kind of dig down around the stump a little bit, not a lot. Don't go all crazy like you're trying to dig the damn thing out. And then you take a long bit, about a half inch wide, maybe depends on the size of the stump, but you run air holes that run through the roots into the center of the tree. And then you come back on the top and put a few more air holes, and if possible, take a chainsaw and make a pit in the center of it, depending on the size of the tree, once again, or make a whole bunch of holes and then whack it out with the backside of an axe or a hammer or whatever to get that plug out of there. And then I have a metal barrel I created where it's got a screen on the top, but the screen hinges open about a third of it or so, So only one third of it hinges open and just has metal screen truss top. It has a little triangle-shaped sight windows right next to the ground that are maybe 4 inches tall and 6 inches wide, and there are holes drilled in that barrel. And so what that does is it keeps all the heat in there so that when you burn the stump, it burns inside and out, right? And so you pour some diesel fuel mixed with kerosene, standard-issue stump killer burner recipe there, maybe with just a touch of gas to get it to light off or use lighter fluid to light it off. But basically you make a fire with sticks and stuff on top of it. And what it'll do is it'll pull the fire down into that stump, dry it and burn it. And it'll burn it all the way down into them roots pretty good. So if you're doing a no-till approach and you don't have a lot of them, that's a helpful thing. And I just found that on the internet while looking at 1,000 different ways to get rid of stumps other than using a mushroom, which is another thing we have in our back pocket that we're working on right now is we'll drill the holes in the stump and then pack it full of mushroom mycelium. And that should rot it down to bare earth. But if you need it quick, fast, and in a hurry, the burn's the way to go, in my opinion, versus bringing in equipment. But it all depends on the size and the scale. If you're doing acres, that burning's going to get pretty old pretty fast. So
now, Matt, when you set up, what did you call the device here? What was the name of the device?
A rocket stove. Yeah.
Rocket stove. That's it. Rocket stove.
Candle, okay. Swedish candle is.
What do you call it?
Swedish candle?
No, I'm not familiar.
It's just like a log that you can basically burn and grill out of. Look it up. You'll see.
Okay. All right. That's interesting. I've done burning, but I've actually not built something like that specifically. Good idea.
Well, I can't take credit for it. The internet provides,
Well, whatever. It's the research and execution. So you made something sounds pretty simple, easy, and cheap. But all right. So that's a cool tactic.
Yep. And I use my my battery powered Ryobi backpack sprayer. If I'd waited 3 more months to buy it, then Milwaukee would have. Milwaukee's got the one on the market with interchangeable tanks. Have you seen that?
Yes, I have.
That Dude, that's the bee's knees. Well, I bought a Ryobi one a few months prior to that because it was just battery powered, and I'm sick of pumping. I hate spraying,
you know,
in that regard. But the Ryobi one works really well. I do a lot with it. I do a lot of foliar feeding of my crops with it as well. So, yep. You know, you just wash it real good, but it works. So, yeah, I'm just, you know, torching it with, you know, Gly and 2,4-D and a little bit of diesel. And then I'm mowing lanes through it. So every time that I go in there now, I have more and more access to different areas, you know, and get it better. Yep. And then, you know, I'm just kind of running a grid through there, and I'm tempted just to mow it, throw, and then mow on top of it, which is a great strategy because you throw the thatch on top of, you know, the seed that you distribute. But there's so much up there, I'd really like to just burn it, you know. And so cutting that in there is helpful, too, because you can burn smaller and smaller pieces the more grid you make.
Yeah, absolutely. I want grids down about a tenth of an acre. That's what I'm doing. Like, that's what I'm recommending to folks, like that small in our particular areas. Now, again, if this is on scale, we're talking 40, 50 acres. I mean, if you have a large property, you're 500, 600, 700 acres, you're going to much larger. But my grid size is about a tenth of an acre. That's where I'm at.
Yeah, I'm doing that. This is even smaller because I can't afford for the fire to run away. There's a nature preserve next door that's several hundred years old of second growth oak, and the people of this county would hang me if it burned.
Yeah, don't do that. Yeah, that doesn't sound good.
And there's a lot of swamp nearby and stuff like that, too, and there's a switchgrass field full of hemlocks and jack pines nearby, so there's fairly decent fire load, and I'm not trying to get into that at all. Well, there's no restrictions on burning, so it's burn at your own risk.
No, that's good. Don't start a forest fire, but burn at your own risk. I get it. So I want to go back, though. You're running on another road. I want to stick to this food plot enhancement and then growth. Sure. So one of the things I do a little bit on some of the properties, and actually I had a client suggest this. Actually, Jim Ward and I talked about something, too. You know what Jim does is Jim, you know, chainsaw man. Jim just... Yeah. Cuts them up and then splinters them out. And I've done that for eons, and it's worked well for me. And I just have a pile of composted soil some distance away. I bring it over and I just cover the stump. And that's done tremendous. I've always had luck with that. It's some of these harder species like hickories are really tough to work with. Some of these really dense wood species are really hard. It takes... You know, you may be on a stump for a good hour, you know, before you get knocked out. And so I just, you know, I want to know any other tricks or tips for people trying to say, you know, save money and do it, you know, physically, getting things knocked out. I mean, I think cutting low as you can to the ground and covering it with soil works well for a lot of people, you know. It doesn't have to be too intricate.
One of the things we're working on is how to turn that knee-high stump into mushroom food, you know, basically, because I see it a lot with deer in the winter where they eat the bracket fungi off of it, especially the more substantial ones, like it's called Salisbury Steak of the Woods or Ishnoderma resinum. They changed the Latin a few years ago. And that's it's one that they'll eat a little bit on the fall, but they really relish it in the winter during the melt-free cycle. When there's no other fungi available, you know, and they're tearing up things like the lichens, you know, the mosses, and they're also eating like turkey tail mushrooms and other dried mushrooms that they may find, like brick caps or enoki or some of the winter oysters, whatever it may be, depending on where you're at in the country. And so what I'm positing and attempting to do as I grow and develop is to basically cut that stump into cookies. You know what a cookie is, right?
Yep. About
4 inches. Yep. Cut it into cookies and then more or less glue it back together with mycelium just by adding layers of mycelium. This is not a new technique. It's called the totem method of mushroom cultivation, but doing it on a live stump versus doing it in a more controlled setting, you know, like you would at a mushroom farm, or a little bit different, not a whole lot. And so basically at the end, we wrap that stump with black plastic bag or, you know, for a while. And it incubates, and when we pull that black plastic bag off after 60 to 90 days, it's usually solid white and ready to produce mushrooms.
I think that's a great idea for folks and something you could do, obviously, on the edges and work through this, you know. Now, moisture is a critical thing to that, correct, Matt? I mean,
that's why we put the black plastic on there, is to retain the moisture. And also, it'd generate a little bit of heat to help it incubate, especially if it's in the shade. If it's in the full sun, I might do a white plastic bag.
Okay, that's good to know. All right, bouncing around. Anything else like new and innovative, something that you're working on that's like practical, hands-on, that might be interesting, that may be simple but productive?
I'm using my perimeter as a black walnut grove moving forward. I'm designing outside in property, right? All the good stuff's on the, inside. And then, of course, the danger comes from the outside, right? And so with that, I'm using the perimeter of the property as access. Well, if I'm going to do that and kind of sacrifice that area, so to speak, I'd like to get some monetary gain from it. So one of the questions that I asked Jim Ward, as a member of Jim Ward's dojo, you should relate to this, is like, if you have a question, you can ask the internet or you can ask Jim Ward. Jim Ward probably had the answer, right? But long story short, I asked Jim and a whole bunch of other folks about it. And a lot of people were like, I don't know. And Jim was like, hell yeah, you can grow grass underneath them. That's all that grows underneath them.
Well, you asked me too, and I know a thing or two. So I was part of your dojo. Wait. Yep. Jim Ward, I like this. Ask Jim Ward. We should do a podcast. Yeah. Ask Jim Ward.
Yeah. Jim Ward, you let listeners send in questions that are impossible for anyone else to answer, and then have Jim on, and I guarantee you he's going to. I've never seen him buy that sharp, And so anyway, Jim was like, yeah, you can grow switch or miscanthus or, big blue stem in particular underneath them walnuts, especially if you're establishing the trees first, but you can go back and do it retroactively. And then he went on to say, you can grow rye and clover underneath of them too if you get the pH right and they've got enough sun. Yeah. And, and that's a big misnomer with the allelopathy is, some crops will grow underneath the black walnuts or other walnuts. I have butternut walnuts in my yard at the old farm. So I knew that tall grass will grow underneath some of them or grow underneath of them. I just didn't know if it would be all of them or, what the limitations were there. And Jim was like, nope, go for it. World's your oyster. So I'm using the edge of the property to plant black walnuts a couple rows deep or whatever with tall grass screening underneath of them to give me good access and, also to create value. I'm probably never going to see the money. My kids, my grandkids probably name someone after me for it, though.
Well, I mean, I think that's important long term. So, a lot of people don't know this, right? So, there are certain species that are susceptible to the black walnut. They produce a chemical called jugolone. And one of the issues there is that it's a toxin. Look at it as a toxin. And I have tried to work with clients to be more familiar with this. Is a lot of times you'll say, well, it's a nut producer, so I should put more nut trees in that particular area because it's devoid of other nut trees. Well, there's a reason behind that. Like, you do not want to plant like your hybridized chestnut trees or American or Chinese chestnut trees in a grove like that. They will not survive. So there's certain species that do not do well. Like alfalfa, I've seen guys try to grow alfalfa. It doesn't work. And so certain species, grass is one of those exceptions. You won't see a lot of blackberries. They'll be devoid of blackberries. I have hinge cut a lot of black walnut trees. So it's a fantastic tree for hinge cutting, by the way. And just to mention, other species that do not grow in those, basswood would be an example, one that I can think of offhand. So, I'm going off my head right now, but there's certain species that do well. Nitrogen producing species, specifically legumes, will not do well in those particular areas. So if you're trying to put a food plot in those particular areas, good luck. It normally doesn't work too well. So,
not only where the trees are, but down water of them. Grains are. You want to make your own Roundup to kill everything but the grass. Go get a whole bunch of black walnut, shells in the when they first come down, and cram a 5-gallon bucket full, halfway or so, and then fill it up with water. Let it sit in the sun for a few days, and that's concentrate. That's the jug of Roundup. It'll kill everything but the grass wherever you pour that.
Yeah, and there are some quote unquote nut producing species that you can add to complement. Like I think you're a big, aren't you like a hazelnut guy? Maybe I'm wrong.
Oh, I love hazelnuts.
All right. I had a feeling you were. I don't
and
know.
And chestnuts too, but yeah.
Yeah. Why are you so big into hazelnuts? Because I like hazelnuts as well.
Man, I'd be just destroyed. Plus, they're delicious. You ever eat Nutella, brother?
Yeah,
they're just so rich. I mean, if you have a cache of nuts like that, that's the ultimate survival food. For in and of itself, so it's you're kind of sufficient in that regard. If all else comes, you can eat nuts all winter,
yeah,
but I love them for wildlife. Now, the nuts do bring in bears. That's a fact, you know, for whatever it's worth. If you got a lot of bears like we do and you're planting a lot of nuts, just know that there's going to be some carryover. But it also brings in a lot of turkeys and other stuff.
Turkeys.
Grouse.
Yep.
Yep. Grouse love hazelnuts.
Matt, do you notice the browse level on hazelnuts to be high, or do you have a large abundance of them so they're kind of normalized in the landscape? What have you seen on your particular properties?
Well, I don't have any hazelnuts on my particular property. Used to have before it became maple-fied with the last few cutovers. Now, my friend John's property is 100 acres 30 miles south of me, and it's sweet ferns and blueberries and hazelnuts and wild plums kind of all growing together in a big guild with oaks. And that property is just amazing with those hazelnuts. But there's so many, they don't really get a whole lot of browse. They don't get hit with the browse as hard.
Sure.
But, you know, if you had a small planting, you're going to need to protect until they get over their head. That's for sure.
So I think when you're building, I'll call this a food forest guild, right? We're talking about producing trees of, you know, significant value to the landscape. Earlier, chestnuts, right? Those are problematic. Hazelnuts are good, at least around these walnut species. I know certain species like persimmons, I've seen those grown near walnut trees. And I think they've done okay. So I think this is a try it out kind of scenario. But also, I think introducing nut producing species like the hazelnuts and some of these others can really be a major benefit. I'm super excited. My Habitat Day on Saturday, which I mentioned earlier, the big part of that is showing this kind of, I built this coliseum. It's really cool. So it's this giant clear cut. And I terraced it. And then I planted a bunch of species, which I won't get into here, but species on these kind of terrace hill. And then across the way, about 120 yards away, I get this long shooting lane, and it's just like, it's a shooting gallery. And I designed it for my son because that's his hunting spot. And, you know, everyone gets their hunting spot. That's his hunting spot. And that's where he'll kill this year. And I'm really excited just to kind of introduce the concept of terracing and building in this infrastructure. Now, the slope in that area is extremely, like, it's probably, I don't know, I want to say 50%. So it's dangerous. So I can't have the clients walk down that particular area, but they can see it from a vantage point. But you can shoot at that vantage point where we're looking down. It's just wonderful. Now, that was chock full of a lot of viney species. So one of the issues that I run into there is a lot of competition. So when you have, like, you know, steep, this is south-facing hillsides, and you have a lot of vine kind of integrated in there and a lot of viney plants in there. What the plants, you got to really, like, get going because they green up super fast. So the first year you won't get much green up. The second year it's like, it's a jungle. So it already has turned into a jungle, but there's a lot of woody material in there because of how it was managed. So I'm just changing the dynamics of that and the maintenance piece of, you know, that particular property. And that's what we're going to explain is how do you maintain a property with steep slopes? Because you can't get tractors in there. A lot of it's hand-to-hand combat. So it's herbicide treatment, hand-to-hand combat, and burning. And it's tough when you have tree species like that are susceptible to fire. So I'm introducing non-fire preferred species, like chestnuts, a good example of that. So although, you know, I have seen, I would think chestnuts would, they're root shooters, man, you know. They're stump and root shoot. So, I mean, I'm thinking the chestnut might not be that bad, although I've never burned a chestnut, so I'm not familiar with doing that. I don't know. Have you ever screwed around with that? I'm just thinking out loud right now.
No, but, I mean, it's a native to Eastern America, you know, a particular in Virginia, you know, that area. That's, I mean, chestnuts are what made Virginia hams famous.
Yeah.
And with that, you know, there were fires there. So, you know, natives burned, we burned the whole country, you know, it's and the country, you know, would catch on fire on its own, you know, as well. So I would undoubtedly think it's a fire of all species, especially if it's a true American chestnut.
Yeah.
But I've never personally witnessed it, so I can't attest.
No, me either. So that'll be a bit of a lesson learned for me. All right. We're getting,
John, we're talking about vines a minute ago. Got something kind of interesting I'm doing. So we have a lot of Mustang grapes or wild grapes, sour grapes that grow here.
Yep.
And particularly on my side of town here in town, because there's a lot of Italians. And there used to be, you know, during Prohibition, my house was kind of used as a hooch factory. We can get into that some other time. But with that, a lot of volunteer vines. And I just yank them out of the ground in the early spring and then repot them into some good mix. And they generally survive. And the reason I'm doing that is, one, to climb up, you know, kind of my my ladder stands and stuff and provide some structure and cover in the long run, because you could train them easily.
Yep.
But then also, one of the things I noticed the last few years that's really – made me open my eyes is probably the biggest grape line I've ever seen is 100 foot long. And it, what it is these grapevines grow up and over a power line or a cable line. And then they have all those little trailers, all those little, you know, leaders that hang down. And in the autumn, man, those deer just come through there and they use every damn one of them as a licking branch scrape. And it's just this long line of this huge scrape. And so that's something I'm trying to emulate at the property, where I want like a hub scrape, is to basically run a cable between two trees, more or less, train grapevine up it and across that cable.
Yeah, I think that's a good natural way to produce scraping activity. And I have actually seen that before, where people have used that as a technique. Great idea. Good thing to share with everybody. I'm certain there's a certain caliper and flexibility with that you can kind of play with to see what's more preferential. Because I've seen that kind of work. I've actually shaved them. I've cut them certain ways. I've tried to replicate what you're saying. And I have seen success with that. And so I think that's a good idea. I'm going to, this is a big to-do on my habitat day, is we're going to talk about how to manage wild grape. I was talking to one of my clients the other day. So, dude, I am so fortunate. I just want to say this. I'm so fortunate. I have a great client that I do some business with. Came over here and he installed the box blind for me for his company. Just fantastic guy, did an excellent job. And we were talking about how to manage grapes, and he was just talking about what they're getting in the Midwest, because, you know, there's just this high volume of wild grape just taking over all these areas, and they're doing it for silviculture purposes, et cetera, and wildlife benefits. But there's, you know, there's a way to cut and style, and we were kind of talking through that. And he's like, you know, I said, what are the guys getting per day? You know, what's the rate? And it was a couple grand a day. I said, a couple grand a day, how many acres are they peeling out? They're like, about 10 acres. I said, you know, that's good. I mean, depending on the density and volume, right, that's one thing in that equation. I was like, I was assuming about 6 to 7 acres just based on my experience. And, you know, if you could, you yourself as an individual can cut those out and place them in certain areas, you're going to get a tremendous benefit. In fact, in my area, it's a giant, I mean, I'm talking like huge benefit to the grouse population. The other thing I did, Matt, recently is I've been kicking these grouse off the property. I shouldn't even say that, but I've been so concerned with my habitat day, the grouse attacking the clients, that I've been over there pushing them off the property. We were considering getting rid of them. And I haven't wanted to do that because of the abundance of them, but they're just so damn territorial. They've become so territorial on that property. You know, they zone out and they spread a little bit right now, but they're very, very temperamental. And I didn't want somebody getting bothered with the habitat day and getting attacked by one. And they will. I mean, they seem like a friendly little guy, but they're not. They're quite aggressive in my particular area. So I don't know.
Well,
maybe I have a demon. Maybe they're demon, the demon grouse that I have. I've got a weird species here.
Well, they're pretty good for giving you a heart check to see if your ticker's working right or not when you almost step on one and they come flushing out of there. That's for sure.
Well, I can tell you, stepping on them, that dissuades them from human interaction. And I've personally done that. And
You know how to get a rooster to stop attacking you, right? You don't hit it with the shovel or fight it with your hat or, you know, what you do is you grab that damn rooster and you pull it to your chest and you snuggle it. You tell it how pretty and cute it is and all the other stuff. That rooster will want nothing to do with you. I promise you, right?
Yeah.
I'm just letting you know, someone who's had some of the most vicious roosters I've ever seen. Same thing with geese. Canada goose comes after me, I'm grabbing it right below the neck and trying to swing my arm around it and tuck it in, because it ain't going to do it very often after that, because it basically, you know, well, I got you, you know, you fucked around to find out. You know, so for whatever it's worth, them grouse come at you, go with them. Don't be scared, John. You're bigger than they are.
Yeah, no, I'm trying not to be scared, but you know, I am worried about others too. And I hear you. I've never thought about caressing one to death or to scarcity. So I think that's something that I might lay out. That so my next plan is to go out tonight. I'm going to try to barehand a couple of them and sweeten them to death.
Maybe bring you a slingshot and have you a nice dinner.
Well, you know, I didn't say you couldn't shoot them with a slingshot. I don't know. We got to be careful here. There's state regulations. I got to be aware of. All right. I won't do anything illegal. Just on this podcast publicly. But anything else from you? We're at the end of this. So anything else from you that you want to kind of relay to the guests? Great ad hoc, by the way. Today we had no agenda, so this is a good chat.
No, I just jotted down. We pretty much hit most of the stuff on my list.
Okay,
you know,
good.
Kind of talking in the last episode about wireworms and cutworms and stuff, and we privately chatted about beneficial nematodes and how mushroom plots basically eat the predatory nematodes and increase the predator abundance, which leads to less nematodes and cut wireworms, et cetera. But if you're turning a new piece of ground into a plot, you should expect a lot of damage from the wireworms, cutworms, things like that the first year. And so, you know, for whatever that's worth, especially with that brassica family, it seems like they cut them all off at the stem.
Yeah, they do. And that attraction, if your soil is such where the residual, particularly in new soil, where most of the organic material is on the top layers, like a good tell is if you have a lot of worms at the very surface of your soil, you're going to get a similar instance of cutworms and those other species. So a lot of larva components going to be at that level. You've got to have depth to your soil. Now, those anti-tillage people that are listening to this podcast, there are opportunities to remineralize your soil at that point in juncture. You need to think about that a little bit, because where you're deficient, absolutely get a soil test throughout that profile. You can start over. My mistake I made years and years ago, I was like, oh, plants fix dirt. And I hear people extremely well known in this industry explain that. I love that the folks at MSU Deer Lab are doing some of the analysis. A lot of this has already been done. I think they're somewhat recreating the wheel, not being critical, but I'm just saying a lot of that testing has been done actually like 15 years ago. And they're relating to wildlife, which I think is a positive, and I think there'll be a lot of lessons learned out of it. But if you balance your soil, we call it soil, the term we typically use is like soil cohesiveness or soil functionality. And there's, you know, I'm going to introduce some new concepts other than like focused on hydrogen levels or potential hydrogen in a landscape. We're going to talk about redox and oxidation of your soils, new concepts. I'll introduce those next year. But ideas and concepts of how to design a balanced soil, I'm going to talk about that at my habitat day. There's a lot of depth to kind of understanding soil composition and what's necessary. And again, each plant is consuming or utilizing, you know, various nutrients, micros and macros. And again, the spice of life is natural forming techniques require inputs. And air is the basis of a lot of that. Calcium and phosphorus are level 2 and 3. And then we're building up the functionality. It would be the rest of the remainder of those plants. And you notice that I didn't mention nitrogen in any of that. So, you know, introducing, I guess, a balanced scenario will actually amend these issues and it'll give you more depth to your soil. So I'm not against tillage, smart tillage, and aerating the soil. It takes 3 to 4 years to start to increase that sucrose or sugar levels in the plants. And I'm just starting to see some increase. And like one of the things I'm going to mention, Matt, real quick, and I need to shut up, is last night I was on the property, right? I basically did a deer drive, kicked all the deer off. I'm sitting there and all of a sudden they came right back. And I'm sitting in the box blind in the rainstorm. I'm watching YouTube videos because I'm too scared to get out in the lightning. And I'm sitting there, and these deer start coming back in the food plot. I'm like, son of a gun, I got to get out of here. And I can't get spotted in this blind. So the closest deer, that just tells you the quality of those food plots, right? They got to come back. So I sneak out of the blind. The closest deer is 10 yards away. I get out of the blind, and now she's directly in line with me. And I sneak up the road, and then I loop all the way around, and I come at her from a totally different direction. So she thinks she heard something, but she didn't know what it was. And then I come all the way around a different direction. I spook out of the food plot. She literally turns around, jumps into a bedding area. I just walked through it a second ago. Jay hooks around and comes right back to the food plot. I'm like, well, I guarantee she's got a fawn in the area. But beyond that, it just goes to show you. And she, I don't know what she was doing next. I don't know if she's going to go take a bite again. But she was just, again, this is during the rain. And she just looped right on. She saw me clear as day. You know, she knew who I was. She's seen me. We're familiar with each other. I know her. She's got a little scar in her back, you know?
Yeah, the familiarity thing. So, yeah, that's huge. You work that property. They know you. They know the difference between John sneaking around and close the blend in like Elmer Fudd and John, you know, working on the buffet, right?
Yeah.
They totally know the difference. One of the things I'm doing to create more of that familiarity aspect, and I got this is another Jim Ward hot tip from the dojo, right? Jim told me one of the strategies that he's seen work well is you take, not to give away all his tips, but every time you go do some work on that property, at somewhere along that property, different spot every time, you lay down a handful of mineral or a handful of, you know, like sweet treats and mineral or something like that. Not enough so it's there for days, enough so that they have to be competitive and go find it. And so basically you're training those deer to go track you down wherever you walked.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And there's a reward at the end of it. And so they don't know the difference between September 30th and October 1st, of course, you know,
I love it. I love this.
Yeah. So for whatever it's worth, that's one of the things that I do. And I just keep a little bucket with some sweet treats and different minerals. And one of the minerals I put out is, in this, you know, aspect is Repel X. It's a bunch of different sulfides supposed to keep the tick load down. And I got to be honest, I have the lowest amount of ticks on my property after midsummer that I've ever had before. And I would like to attribute some of that to, you know, things that I'm doing, like filling little PVC pipes with polyfill that's soaked in perethrin, and then the dang mice take it and make the nest with it, and that helps keep it down too. But that mineral thing, you know, just wherever I go, and one of the last things I do, not always the last thing, but one of the last things I do is I put that down, and I make sure my hands touch every bit of that. I touch the area around it. I rub my, you know, my sweat off and wipe it on a rock or whatever. I want it to stink like me. And it's just a conditioning exercise.
Yeah, I like it. Hey, I meant to ask you this question in the beginning. We skipped over this. Is what's in your mineral? Because I think a lot of people are wondering, when you're talking about your mineral rock that you're creating, you know, going away from the trophy rock or block rock, and you're creating your own mineral. What's in that?
Another Jim Ward hot tip, Redmond Ag Mineral. That's what all that other stuff has in it.
Oh, boy.
So you get past everyone else and go straight to the source. You buy that off Tractor Supply pretty cheap, or Amazon or whatever, Redmond Ag Mineral. And then a little bit of sea salt, and then I mix molasses to make it stick with the rock whenever I do my scrub, and a little bit of water. That's for the mineral lick itself. And then whenever I'm going out and doing it, I have a bag of Red Zone cotton candy, which is like popped cottonseed meal and some other stuff. And then the other mineral I use is called, I think it's called Repel X from Grandpa Ray's Outdoors. And that was a promo that was given to me by somebody, and anyway, long story short, I've been using it up. And yeah, so, I mean, we're talking not very much mineral. I have like a $50 to $100 mineral budget a year.
Yeah.
I'm not it out all the time.
Yeah, no, that sounds great. I think everything you said there is quite interesting. You and I are cut from the same cloth. It sounds like you, me, and Jim are kind of aligned, at least minerals. I can't use any mineral here in New York State, but just recommendations through other states where it is authorized. I've come up with a concoction.
Yeah, it's legal to bait here. It's legal to run feeders here. It's legal to, you know, and that just turned around. We were in a CWD zone up until last year, but now it's illegal again. It's legal again to do it all. Now, I never stopped anybody. There were giant pallets of corn and carrots and apples at every gas station, and salt blocks right inside the door, right next to the Hunter's Orange Hats, you know. I mean, this is a UP. It's a nobody stopped baiting. Let's just say that. I don't like bait. Bait costs money. I'd rather use that for seed money.
Oh, gosh, yes. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, yeah. No, I don't want to even start going down that road. All right. Let's try to end it there. We've been we extended our stay today. We want to keep good graces with the audience, because I think people like short, sweet, and a lot of information. So, Matt, thanks for sharing all your individual tips and exposing some of Jim's, which is good. And then I really appreciate the information you're willing to share, and just your ability to be innovative and kind of exposing new facts, right? Looking at things differently, kind of approaching this in a test science scenario. Like, you know, get out there and try new things. I think, you know, the more feedback I can get, I mean, send me stuff. If you guys are working on cool things that you've seen be productive, and you've started to kind of take an observational perspective where you've got some good anecdotal evidence to say, hey, you know, observation is evidence. Let's be clear about that. And these are conjunctive with some other facets of your property design and layout, I'm all ears. I am absolutely all ears. I'd love to have a client listener come on to this podcast and be like, let me expose all these things I'm working on. And, you know, sharing, you know, with their good graces, kind of, you know, their good faith and experience with new ideas and techniques. I mean, I think that's what you do. And I appreciate your honesty and just openness to sharing. So I want to thank you.
No worries. Thank you, John, for giving me the opportunity to, you know, talk about all this and for being interested in it, of course. And, you know, I don't know, I'm just a poor boy, you know, I kind of do things the old school way. I don't like to spend any more money than I have to. Everything costs more than it ought to. You know how it goes these days. But
yep.
I can help somebody else put a little more food on their table and spend a little less on their property. I think that's a reward.
Yeah, and Matt, just so people are familiar with you, let's just pump your business. So if you're interested in mushrooms on your property, get a hold of Matt. So Matt, how did they get a hold of you?
Myco Habitat is my business name. Myco is Latin for mushroom, M-Y-C-O, and then, of course, Habitat. Myco-Habitat.com. Facebook, we're on Facebook as Myco Habitat as well. You can reach out to me. All my contact info is there. And, you know, if you're looking to put mushrooms in on your property, it's kind of our thing.
Yeah, cool. All right, brother. We will talk soon and look forward to just chatting this summer.
All right. Take care, John. Thanks for having me on.
All right, brother. See you, man. Bye.
Maximize Your Hunt is a production of Whitetail Landscapes. For more information on how John Teeter and his team of experts can help you maximize your hunt, check out whitetaillandscapes.com.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.